Hey everyone, it's Bobby here. Welcome to this special Good Friday episode of Bible Worm. Since we recorded a Maundy Thursday special episode this year, we decided to re-release this Good Friday episode from Season 1, originally released on April 4th, 2020. It's full of great stuff, including me singing the theme song. We hope you enjoy it.
Bible Worm, Bible Worm, it's a special Good Friday episode of Bible Worm.
Welcome, friends, to a special Good Friday episode of Bible Worm. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, here, as always, with Dr. Bobby Williamson. We are two Bible scholars and people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian. Bobby is an associate professor of religion at Hendricks College in Little Rock, as well as founding pastor at Mercy Church in that same town. I'm the executive director at Congregation Beit Haverim in Atlanta. Together, we are Bible Worm, with you, finding pathways through the darkness. Today we read Mark chapter 15, verses 16 through 41. We will talk about the humiliation and abandonment that so often accompanies and exacerbates our suffering, about vessels of God's holiness breaking open into the world, and about what it means to have supporters out there that you may never know about. Thank you for being here.
Hello, Bobby.
Hey, Amy. You doing okay?
I'm doing all right. We are we're recording this extra episode for Good Friday.
Yeah.
And we get to fit it into our schedules. So it's kind of early in the morning, which is not usually when we record. And I think our voices are a little lower than normal.
Yeah.
So this is the baritone Bible Worm.
Yeah. Baritone Bible Worm. I like it. Bible Worm, Bible Worm.
It's like the smooth jazz of Bible Worm.
The smooth jazz, the slightly sleepy.
Yeah, it's very smooth. Well, we can use some smooth and relaxing tones to take us through the crucifixion text.
Oh my goodness, yes.
It's intense. It's intense. It's meant to be. We are reading Mark chapter 15.
Yeah.
The narrative lectionary is verse 16 to 39.
But Bobby, as always.
Bobby can't control himself. So we might add just two more verses through 41, just a little bit.
The only real mention of female followers of Jesus in the Gospel of Mark comes in the two verses following the narrative lectionary. And I feel like we gotta pay our respects.
We gotta raise that up.
Yeah.
So with that, we are going to dive in, and I am starting in verse 16. Then the soldiers led him into the courtyard of the palace, that is, the governor's headquarters, and they called together the whole cohort, and they clothed him in a purple cloak, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on him, and they began saluting him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They struck his head with a reed, spat upon him, and knelt down in homage to him. After mocking him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. So clearly this is a mocking scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
But more specifically, it's mocking the claim that he's king of the Jews, and I think maybe modeled on the way that Caesar may be hailed.
Yeah, that's my understanding, and I think that's right. Yeah, so the purple cloak is a color of royalty. It's, of course, the crown of thorns, the Greek says they put it around his head, not on his head, which sounds maybe like that laurel wreath, you know, that Caesar wore.
Yeah.
Hail, King of the Jews, sounds like hail Caesar. So I think that's the usual understanding, is that they're mocking his claim to be the King of the Jews, and they're doing it by bowing down to him in a mocking style, the way that one would pay homage to Caesar.
It's so interesting to me. I mean, God, human beings are just a disaster sometimes. And right? This is one of those times. You know, like, they already have decided they're going to crucify this man.
Yeah.
And they take time out to go through this bizarre ritual where they dress him up in funny clothes and just do things to make him feel... I mean, it's so, like, childish in the face of such a huge act of violence that's about to occur.
Yeah.
It's like they're playing dress-up dolls right before they commit this atrocity.
Yeah, and, you know, we've got this idea of, you know, people who have power, people who have the force of the government behind them, people who have the weapons, people who can carry out justice, you know, rightly or wrongly, but you know, in the justice system. And they seem to be kind of drunk with this sense of power, and they can abuse this prisoner of theirs. Jesus doesn't put up much of a fight here. Like, he's a pretty passive character in this whole story.
He's very passive, yeah.
So that I think they just think they can, you know, do what they want with him.
And maybe, you know, the first thing that came to my mind reading this, strangely enough, was those images that were in the news of Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
And like, the memory of the way that the prisoners there were humiliated.
Yeah, I was thinking about Abu Ghraib.
Yeah. Abu Ghraib. Maybe that's actually what I meant. But in any case, right, I mean, this is a thing that people do when they're drunk with power, and maybe also because there is about to be, there is the potential for a great act of violence, and so the dehumanization sort of paves the way for that to feel okay.
Yeah, oh, I see. So sort of psychologically for the soldiers themselves.
Yeah. It's this.
That's an interesting reading, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting that Mark is doing here, and we'll see it all through this this story, but, you know, Mark really does think that Jesus is the king of the Jews, right?
Mm-hmm.
What these soldiers are doing is actually, in this deeply ironic way, is recognizing who Jesus is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the very way in which they're demeaning him is actually proclaiming who, in Mark's understanding, he actually is. He does deserve this kind of worship. He is to be honored over Caesar. He is the king of the Jews. He is to be hailed. He should be clothed in royal finery. So the soldiers are doing all of these things, but what they mean by it is not at all the way it should be done.
Right. And it seems, you know, for as much as that Mark can be a sort of sparse narrator sometimes, he does have these lovely literary, I guess, moments where things resonate on different levels, and the people in the story may understand it on a certain level, but we as readers, or Mark as the writer, understand that it has more resonance than that.
Yeah.
I am picking up in verse 21. They compelled a passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross. It was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Then they brought Jesus to the place of Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his clothes among them, casting lots to decide what each should take. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two bandits, one on his right and one on his left.
This Simon character is really interesting because, you know, Jesus had said to the other Simon, Peter, back in chapter 8, like, you're going to have to take up your cross and follow me. And Peter had said, you know, yeah, I can do that. And then Peter is nowhere to be found, Simon right. Peter. But here we have Simon of Cyrene, who does take up not his own cross, takes up Jesus's cross and bears it for him. The posting of the King of the Jews in the other Gospels, it's over his head. It's not actually said in Mark that it's attached to the cross in any way, but this is kind of like a little announcement about, so people passing by, like, crucifixion was a public thing.
Right.
It was a deterrent. People could see people being crucified and say, I don't want to get in that situation. And so what did he do was part of the question.
Right.
So this is like Jesus's sentence, and it just says the King of the Jews.
Right. Instead of saying insurrection or, you know, something that might sound more like a crime, the fact that the King of the Jews is written over him or by him, again, sounds like Mark working on multiple levels.
I think that's exactly right, yeah. So the Romans mean it in kind of a mocking way, like, this guy said he was the King of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when you just read it, there's Jesus and there's the proclamation, King of the Jews. And for those those in Mark's community who read it, like, that is an accurate description of what Jesus is. Mm-hmm. To a reader of Mark, even though the Romans mean it as demeaning.
And an accurate description of why he is crucified.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know?
Along those same lines, those two guys that are crucified on either side of him, the NRSV has bandits?
They're bandits.
Mm-hmm. In the CEB, they're outlaws, which sounds a little cooler, like Bonnie and Clyde or something like that.
Western movie, yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes in the Christian tradition, you'll hear people talk about them as like thieves or robbers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But thievery and robbery weren't crucifixion crimes.
Yeah.
So the Greek word that's being used here is leistai. So these guys are like Jewish nationalist freedom fighters. They're rebellion leaders against Rome.
That's interesting. That does. I feel like that casts a little bit of a different light on it in my mind. I don't know why.
Can you say a little more about that?
As you said, sort of. Well, I just had pictured him sort of. I guess I had originally pictured it as another way in which Jesus is dishonored in his death is to be crucified among petty thieves.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
But to say he's crucified amongst political revolutionaries who, or freedom fighters, or people who are trying to overturn the power structures that exist.
Yeah.
I don't know. That seems less sort of out of place in the context of the work that in some ways Jesus was trying to do.
Yeah.
You know? Just with words and not with violent coups or whatever those other people were doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so Jesus here is being placed on a side in the political structure with those people who are trying to fight on behalf of the Jewish people over and against their Roman occupiers. The one other thing, or another thing, is this reference in 24. So first of all, that's where Jesus is crucified, and it's three words in Greek. It's three words in the CEB, they crucified him. That's all the description that you get. The second thing is, in that same verse, they divided up his clothes, drawing lots to determine who would take what. This seems to be Mark referring to Psalm 22, which he does several times throughout this telling of the crucifixion. So in Psalm 22:18, they divvy up my garments among themselves. They cast lots for my clothes. So we'll see a couple of times along the way that Mark seems to be using that psalm in some way to orient his telling of Jesus' crucifixion.
And I appreciate all of the different scriptural references throughout this text. And also, those details just ring true to me in terms of how humans behave in these situations. You know, that often when there is this kind of dehumanization and violence against a person, then yeah, you divide up their stuff and take it. Like, I don't know, it seems like the life of the person becomes smaller and smaller and smaller until you don't even remember that the clothing that you have is from someone that you killed. Now it's just a new shirt for you. There's so much resonance with the violence in the world today for me.
No, that's really well said. Yeah, absolutely.
We are at verse 29. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha! You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests, along with the scribes, were also mocking him among themselves, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from the cross now, so that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also taunted him.
Here we have another reference to Psalm 22. In that first verse that you read, people walked by insulting him, shaking their heads. In Psalm 22:7, all who see me make fun of me, they gape, shaking their heads. He committed himself to the Lord. Let God rescue him. Let God deliver him because God likes him so much. And so here you can hear that verse kind of behind this, actually this whole little section that we just read.
Yeah.
But this kind of mocking, scoffing, and even the other criminals being crucified with him are casting insults on him.
They're mustering the energy as they hang on their own cross.
Yeah.
To somehow vault themselves over Jesus.
Yeah, what do you think that's about?
Imaginary power. I mean, I guess it's just, you know, instead of saying, hey, our lots have landed together and here we are.
Right.
To have this last grasping for power and grasping for not being at the bottom of the heap.
Yeah.
They too want to at least be above someone. And so they're going to make that someone Jesus.
Wow, that's really powerful. Like, in their last dying breaths, what they're trying to do is gain some status over somebody else.
Right, and after all the times that Jesus said, like, the last will be first.
Yeah.
People really don't want to be last.
No, they don't.
They really don't want to be last.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned earlier Jesus's passivity throughout this whole story, and it is remarkable. I mean, I know the people walking by are just mocking him. But Jesus has said many times pretty profound things about the power of faith in God. You can move a mountain if you believe you can do it. You can, you know, like you can do incredible things. So in some ways, their question is a valid question.
Oh, absolutely.
What, talk to me about how you read that.
Jesus never gives people everything they need in this gospel in order to be convinced that he is who he says he is. There is always a gap that has to be crossed by faith. You have to trust that it's true.
Yeah.
And so this is another instance of that.
Oh, that's really beautiful. I like that.
The other thing to say is, like, there is going to be a sign, and it's going to come on Sunday when, you know, death is defeated and Jesus rises from the dead, right? Like, it's going to be an amazing...
Hang tight, people.
Right. And so for Jesus to, like, hop down off the cross and be like, ha-ha...
that was a funny image.
Like, Jesus could do the self-interested thing and prove who he is, save himself from death, like overcome all this mocking and derision and have people worship him. But instead, he chooses to give up his own life for the greater good, which is, you know, going to be resurrection and the defeat of death. According to the gospel, the defeat of death for everybody.
I keep thinking about the power of letting this scene play out the way it does with Jesus saying so little and, you know, in some ways being the center of the story and in some ways just being like the mirror that is held up to the society that he is a part of.
Yeah.
You know, and Jesus's quiet and passivity in this moment forces people ultimately to see who they are and what they've done.
Yeah.
But not immediately.
Yeah.
Verse 33. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. At 3:00, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, listen, he's calling for Elijah. And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come and take him down. Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was God's son. Where do we even start, Bobby?
To me, the most striking part of this story, and maybe the most striking part of the Gospel of Mark, and maybe the most striking part of the Gospels, is Jesus dying, and the words on his lips are, my God, why have you forsaken me? In Mark and in Matthew, that's the last thing Jesus ever says. And I mean, there's a lot to say about that. I think one is that is again a reference to Psalm 22, verse 1. I read that as Jesus experiences himself in this moment as actually having been abandoned by God.
Yeah.
And so here you have a Jesus who has been abandoned by Peter, denied by Peter, abandoned by his disciples. He's been mocked. The criminals on his right and left are mocking him. And now he experiences God as abandoning him. So he is totally alone at the lowest point that one could be. And all he knows to do is cry out. I mean, in a little bit of an accusing voice, like, God, why have you abandoned me? Like, you should be here, but you're not. I just think that is so powerful, as a way of presenting. Like, this is the Messiah, right? This is the savior of the world in Christian understanding. And this is something, the last thing he ever says in his earthly existence. And in the Gospel of Mark, the last thing he ever says, is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Thoughts about that?
I mean, I agree with you. It's just overwhelmingly powerful. I mean, I keep thinking that Jesus has known this was going to happen and has been, you know, in various ways telling his people that this was going to happen and trying to prepare them for it and has submitted completely to this as it has unfolded. And still the enormity of the suffering of his body in that moment, mm-hmm. or maybe combined with the emotional suffering of having been abandoned, even though he knew he was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, like, even though he believed with perfect faith that this is all how it would unfold.
Yeah.
The suffering was still so enormous that he cried out to God in that way.
Yeah.
And I think that really says something about how faith and suffering work, and that faith doesn't always sort of take the day in that moment, you know,
yeah.
that you can cry out in this way, and that this suffering is really real.
Thinking that one of the ways that this gets talked about in my community at Mercy Church, where many of my folks are, you know, living on the street and struggling with addiction and mental illness, and they are having a hard time. And one of the ways that I read Mark and that they tend to read Mark is this depiction is trying to literally put Jesus at the lowest possible point that a human being can be. Mm-hmm. Feeling abandoned by friends, abandoned by family, abandoned now by God, being punished for something he didn't do, like in his dying breath. And the way that gets interpreted, which I think is really beautiful, is Jesus has been at the lowest point that a person can be, and therefore there is nothing that anyone can go through that Jesus has not also experienced. So no matter how low you feel, you're not actually alone in your lowness, because Jesus experienced that as well. That gives people a lot of hope in my community. So I think there's something to that.
No, I think that's beautiful. And you're right. No, nobody wants to be at the bottom. And Jesus here is at the lowest of the low points.
Yeah.
So that no one else has to ever be alone at that point. Can we talk about the tearing of the curtain?
Yeah.
So I am reading this as the curtain, in Hebrew, the parochet, that is in the temple, that is sort of between the Holy of Holies,
yeah.
the most holy place, where like even the priests don't generally
yeah.
go, and like the main part of the sanctuary where the priests generally go,
yeah.
but the public doesn't generally go. I'm picturing it as that.
Yeah.
That curtain.
So the tearing of that curtain now implies that that holiest space, the Holy of Holies, has been opened up in some kind of a way, like good or bad.
Yeah.
Where does your head go in interpreting what the significance of that might be?
I mean, it went in a couple different ways. One was to think about sort of like revelation or apocalypse, like literally pulling back the curtain
yeah.
that divides the godly realm from the human realm.
Yeah.
Which I guess could be a positive, though terrifying thing.
Yeah.
One was to think about sort of a failure of the whole temple system.
Yeah.
Like the whole temple system was set up in a way that like there are there are rules and there are dividers and there are like measures in place to try to keep things running effectively. And this critical piece of it has now been rendered dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Right. A torn curtain doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the best thing to say is that it is sort of like a pulling back of the curtain. Like it is, this is the revelation. This is the apocalypse. This is
yeah.
like the division between zones has been breached.
Yeah, I love all of that. And like the way that I have typically read that is to say the religious establishment has until now controlled access to God. And God has been behind a veil, behind a curtain. And now the curtain is torn. And so God's presence is just opened out to the people.
Yeah.
The temple has lost some of its centrality, and God seems to be kind of freeing God's self up in some way to work outside the religious establishment and to say, no, here I am. The temple apparatus is no longer necessary for the people to access God. It might be worth noticing that the Greek word here for the tearing is schizo. And the other use of that in Mark was back in 1:10 at Jesus' baptism when the heavens ripped open and the dove came down out of heaven. And so you've got right at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, the rending of heaven, right at the end of Jesus' ministry, the rending of the temple. So I don't know quite what to do, but that hardly seems accidental in
right.
Mark's telling. And so somehow these,
right.
the ripping open of heaven, the ripping open of the temple curtain, I think are being connected to each other.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. No, I like what you said about Mark is not writing a systematic theology.
Yeah.
He's putting in a lot of resonance and a lot of meaning. And, you know, we can almost feel it. You can feel it in the text more easily than you can, you know, get it into one clear equation. There's not an equation.
No, I really, the way that you're thinking about how this text holds up a mirror to the human nature, I think is, like, I really love that reading. I mean, it's disturbing to me, but I think it's
very disturbing.
Yeah, it's a really powerful way of reading the text, and which leads to this last notice in verse 39 of the centurion, who sees how Jesus dies and says, this man was, in the CEB, this man was certainly God's son. Truly, this man was God's son. And so, in the moment of Jesus' death, crying out, why have you abandoned me, God? The centurion then says this, like he actually proclaims who Jesus is as God's son. But we don't know, like we don't have anything about his tone or his, you know, like what his attitude is. Like, I'm just curious, do you read the centurion as like actually getting it? Do you read him as another, like this is another mocking of Jesus? Or what's your take on that centurion?
I did not read this comment as mocking, although now that I go back, I don't know quite why I didn't. Because I don't think that the centurion would have known that the curtain of the temple was torn.
Yeah.
Right? He's just standing in front of Jesus and sees the way that he took his last breath and that he cried out in that way. And what from that would have... What information could he have taken from that, that he suddenly would have realized that this was God's son? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how to read that either. Like, in this way that Mark has been ironic, you can read this ironically as a centurion saying, surely that was God's son, right? Look at that pitiful way that guy died. And what he says turns out to actually be true. But I don't love reading it that way just because it, like... I don't know. I guess I want to give this centurion the benefit of the doubt for some reason, but that, but there is something about the way Jesus has died that makes him just for a moment recognize the truth. He doesn't worship Jesus or like convert to being a Jesus follower or anything like that. He just
has a moment of recognition.
I don't really know what to do with that. I just find that a fascinating detail of this text.
Maybe we can come back to that in our wrap up a little bit. Let's take the last two verses that we're adding into the narrative lectionary here, verses 40 and 41. There were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the Younger, and of Joseph and Salome. These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. I find this note so interesting because we've just gone through the whole crucifixion and death, and you would get the sense that Jesus was completely alone, that nobody had really followed, none of his followers from Galilee had continued to care for him. And then afterwards, after his death, you hear, actually, there were some women who did write by Jesus.
Yeah.
Were writer.
They did writer. Yeah, absolutely.
They did writer.
Yeah.
Why do you think this notice is here?
Yeah, what you've just said, I think, is really important. That's one of the reasons that we wanted to include it is just this sense of abandonment. There is a sense in which the women who have followed Jesus, who have not been important at all in this gospel, turn out to be the ones who have abandoned him the least, or they've been with him to the end. I mean, they're at a distance, so they're not, you know, there with him, but they're there, and they are have been more faithful to him in that sense than Peter and the other disciples.
And I don't even get the sense that Jesus knows they're there.
I think, to me, that's right. Yeah.
Which, again, is a little bit of a corrective is too strong a word, but this sense of complete abandonment that we may have at moments in our life.
Yeah.
There is, like...
Oh, I love that.
Jesus actually wasn't alone.
Yeah.
He just didn't know they were there.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's a beautiful reading. So there were people who were supporting him the way that they could.
Yeah.
And even though he didn't know.
He just didn't know.
I love that.
But it's too bad he didn't know because it really would have alleviated his suffering.
Yeah.
Some.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Well, that brings us to the end of this very, very intense section of the lectionary. What stands out to you for our communities today?
You know, I've mentioned it already, but the part of this text that always stands out to me is that sense of abandonment that Jesus has at the end of his life. My God, why have you forsaken me? And that sense that Jesus himself experiences this hopeless moment, even though he knows, like he has told three times his disciples that there is resurrection coming. On Sunday, three days hence, I'm going to be resurrected. And yet in that last moment of his life, what's on his lips is abandonment, which I read as, hopelessness might be strong, but he is not leaning into the hope. He is experiencing this.
This was worse than he thought it was going to be.
And no one is there for him. I really loved where you were headed just there at the end, that even in that experience of no one is here for me, there were people there for him. They were just at a distance that he couldn't see them. Mm-hmm. And then I was mentioning with the darkness from noon to three and the tearing of the curtain in the temple, like God was also there in the midst of that. Like the universe itself was in some way responding to this moment and taking away the light from the world, and God tears the curtain in the temple. So there were signs around that Jesus was not in fact alone. But they were not signs that Jesus could process. And one of the reasons that I really wanted us to do this text, and I'm glad that we've done it now, is that there is a temptation in the Christian tradition, and this was what we did in my church growing up, is we would have Palm Sunday. Maybe we would have Maundy Thursday, where we would celebrate the Last Supper, and then we would skip straight to Easter, and we just would not talk about the Good Friday part of this text. But in this moment that we are currently living, I feel like the Good Friday text is crucial. And maybe that's true in all moments, for many people. But in this moment, it feels like it's been kind of exposed for all of us that, this is a dark moment and many of us feel frightened and not sure of the future. We are socially distanced. We're not sure who's around for us. We don't necessarily feel God's presence among us at this moment. The world is responding in this strange way that we don't understand. And so to me, the messages there are something like that is a legitimate experience, to feel abandoned and hopeless in this moment, that Jesus himself has also experienced that sense of abandonment and hopelessness and being overwhelmed by the darkness of the Friday without any kind of ability in the moment to lean into the hope of the Sunday, that there are people around, even if we don't know it, that God is around, even if we can't see it, but to let the Friday be the Friday and to be able to name, my God, why have you forsaken me? To be able to name what we are feeling and experiencing in this moment, trusting that God can handle it and that there is something about honesty that's important. And we don't need to rush, Sunday's coming in the Easter story, resurrection is happening. But we don't have to lean into that too quickly when it doesn't feel like we can inhabit that part of the story. We can inhabit this part of the story, which is what Jesus is doing. He knows what's going to happen, but he is living in and limited by the moment that he's experiencing. I think there's something important to that, about that, for the life of the church in this moment and just for the life of each of us who are living through this time.
I think that's really beautiful and really important. And I know that, humans don't like suffering, right? Who likes suffering? And so when we encounter other people who are in suffering, it's so easy to push them through, try to push them into the hope, right? To push them from Friday to Sunday. Yeah. But you're right. This story is really a corrective to that. When I've had difficult things happen into my life, on more than one occasion, I've had someone reach out who had a similar experience who said something like, "Welcome to the club that nobody wants to be a part of." But that is such a profound thing. No, indeed, nobody wants to be a part of that. And we wish none of it had happened. But I feel like what one of the things that you have led me to see in this text this week is that the very fact that Jesus has been at the lowest of the low means that Jesus is always in your club.
Yeah.
You know, it is really helpful to know that you are not alone in your aloneness.
So what do you see when you read this text?
You know, and to a certain extent, I think I've sprinkled it throughout the podcast, but this really is a biblical text that for me holds up a mirror to how humans treat each other. And, you know, while we know that for the, you know, in terms of what this text understands to be God's plan or the theology that's at play, the death of Jesus has to happen, right? There is something bigger happening that the individuals in this story can't control. And the cruelty was really not necessary, mm-hmm. you know? And I think Mark's underscoring of the fact that it is not the physical suffering he is drawing our attention to. It is the fact that people are being needlessly cruel is a reminder to me that though there are many things going on in the world right now and in our lives right now that we can't control and we wish they weren't happening and we can stand aside and say pretty clearly these things are terrible, there also are things that we can control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mirror, right? Like that's where each of us on our own conscience can bring whatever kindness and light and companionship into this moment in history that we can. We actually have a fair bit of power to alleviate people's suffering, even if we can't solve what seems like the big problem.
Mm. That's really beautiful. I'm so glad you came back to that, because that piece that you raised about this text, I had not thought of it really that way before, and that has really been important for me in this reading. And I love where you went with it there at the end. And even like in this text, what the women can do for Jesus is feel compassionately about him from afar and witness mm-hmm. his reality, and mm-hmm. which isn't much, but it's something. And if, as like you said earlier, if Jesus had known that they were there, that might have brought him some comfort, even though they weren't able to touch him or mm-hmm. Comfort him or do anything. Just knowing that they were there would have been something. And so even if that's all we can do, like that's something we can do.
Right. We should do the things we can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad that we did this little extra episode.
Me too. Yeah.
I can't believe the crucifixion comes in as extra, but
yeah.
This Good Friday episode. Yeah. It certainly sets us into a better position to look at the resurrection text.
I think that's right.
Days. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's good to talk to you, Amy. And
it's good to talk to you, too.
We'll do it again on Easter.
Very soon. Yeah. 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 Sounds good. Y'all take care.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Bible Worm. We wish you a happy Easter season and a happy Passover season, and we hope you'll be back with us again soon. Take care.